I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I don't think I ever took any physics classes in school, and if I probably did, I've forgotten it already. Joining me now is one of the world's foremost theoretical physicists. He's got a new book out called Time Reborn, From the Crisis in Physics to the Future of the Universe. I've started it, but I'm probably in over my head, so I'll ask Lee Smolin to tell us about his book, why we should read it, and what exactly his hypothesis is, and how it diverges from the laws of physics as commonly held. Lee Smolin is a founding faculty member at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Toronto, an adjunct professor of physics at the University of Waterloo, and a graduate faculty member in the philosophy department at the University of Toronto. He has published hundreds of scientific papers in three previous books, The Trouble with Physics, The Life of the Cosmos, and Three Roads to Quantum Gravity. His website is at leesmolin.com. This book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Platt Online program in Vancouver today, Lee Smolin. Professor Smolin, good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Who should read this book? And you have an academic background, but you've written three popular books already. When you set out to write a book like this, do you have someone in mind that ought to read it?
I have in mind a person without an education in physics, but with a curious, open mind who wants to know what the universe is, what time is, and why it matters.
So for those of us that value time, it's all part of our lives, I guess. What's in this book that would perhaps change our attitude or mind about time?
See, I think many of us live with a paradox when it comes to time, because we all experience our lives in the moment. Everything we know, everything we experience is in the moment, which we understand, which we experience is one of a flow of moments. So nobody argues that time doesn't exist in the sense of the moments, but many of us think that what's really, really real is something behind those experiences, that those experiences are a kind of illusion, and that behind them are truths which are outside of time. Many of us believe that religious truths or moral truths or the truths of mathematics are all standing outside of time and somehow are greater than the things that we experience within time. And that's a paradox, and that paradox owes a lot to the history of Western thought and scientific, to the development of science, and the point of my book is that that's based on a mistake, on a wrong interpretation of the history of science and the evidence that we have, and that there's no reason, in fact, on the basis of science, to imagine that there's anything in the world that does not exist caught up in time in the moment.
Let's begin with how time is perceived in a way so that a layman like me could understand. What are the sort of commonly held views on time in your community, and where do you diverge from them?
Many people in my community think that time is an illusion. Einstein said once in a letter to the widow of a friend who had died, in a kind of consolation, and many people hope for this kind of consolation, that we who understand physics, Einstein said, understand that the difference between the past, present, and future is nothing but a stubbornly persistent illusion. And this persistent idea through philosophy and science that our experience, as vivid as it is essentially an illusion, and that behind that is a reality, a greater reality that we can transcend to, at least in our minds, which is timeless, is quite the imagination of me. It's why I went into physics, was to discover those timeless truths. And many people in my profession of physics believe that their job is to discover the timeless truths behind the illusion of the present moment and its passage.
And in thinking the way that you're thinking, how does that change one's life? I mean, has your life changed a great deal because of this insight that you might have?
My life changed a lot. First of all, as I just said, I went into physics after reading something very romantic of Einstein when I was 17, in which he talked about science as a kind of transcendental vocation in which you aspire to rise above the vagaries of life and the difficulties and pain of everyday life and discover timeless truths in the equations that discover the world. And giving up that consolation and that hope was emotionally traumatic for me. It's replaced by something which is, to me, equally, if not more, compelling, which is the idea that our choices, our agency, our creativity, our imagination, all give us the capacity to invent new ideas, new solutions to problems, and to realize them. See, some of what has been wrongly understood or wrongly interpreted, in my view, is this idea that the laws of nature are deterministic, and if they're deterministic, then it means that the future is already written in the laws of nature applied to the present, that you don't need to live and experience to know what's going to happen to you or to anybody else in the future. If you had a large enough computer, you could program in the laws of nature. If you could observe precisely where all the atoms were, you could put that into the program as input. And the program would output everything that transpires in the future, which means that time, in a certain sense, isn't real. It can be replaced by a computation. And it means that the impression we have of inventing things and of willing things is an illusion. And the point of my book is to explain why this isn't so. For me, it's very important. A lot of people, when faced with problems in their life or when faced with big problems we all face, like climate change, a lot of people I know have a kind of fatalistic attitude. Well, it's already written. I can think that I matter, but I don't actually matter because history is already written and determined. And The point is, and it takes several chapters of the book to take the reader through it, but this is really based on an unreasonable extrapolation of what we know and is on a reasonable reading of what we actually know about the natural world. There's no reason to think this.
So we can, physics can teach us about the future. We can affect the future. That involves rewriting certain laws of physics, does it?
It doesn't involve rewriting any of our current knowledge. See, the mistake is in taking all of our current knowledge applies to situations of small parts of the universe, situations inside a laboratory or situations that take up a limited domain of space and time, like a solar system or a galaxy. And before you draw any conclusions from these laws of nature as we understand them, you have to imagine that they extend for all time and for all space. And it's that extrapolation which I argue is illegitimate. The physics is just fine the way that we always use it. In laboratories, its explanatory power is immense. It's highly successful as a science, but sometimes people forget that there are built-in limitations to the kind of knowledge that is so powerful that we use from science, and they just imagine that they're doing philosophy and metaphysics rather than science, and just pretend. You see, we've discovered laws of nature which hold us in the present universe. But how do we know that there weren't universes previous to ours in which the laws were not different? And indeed, if you want to explain what the laws are, not just understand what they are, but explain how they came to be, and you want to understand how the laws came to be within science, they have to have a history. They have to have a reason why they developed to be what they are, and that means that they evolve in time, and that means that they're not permanent.
Have you found in working in academia, as you do, that certain disciplines of science, say people in physics as you are and people in biology and chemistry, that there isn't a connection in terms of understanding each other, maybe?
I think that we don't understand each other enough, and it's something that I've long been concerned with. I think that because of the kind of silos that are our universities are structured around, you can be a leading physicist, a leading theoretical physicist, and know nothing about what the biologists are doing or they're doing in medicine, and not even have any idea what leading artists are saying to each other or what they think are important questions or problems. And I think that that's a problem. I think that our culture has a kind of incoherence because, I mean, the job of a scientist is to explore the frontiers of knowledge, just like the job of artists is to explore the frontiers of our imaginative progress. The job of politicians is to explore the frontiers and develop novel frontiers in how we all organize ourselves and get along with each other. And I think the fact that there aren't enough conversations on between people on the boundaries of our knowledge in all the different domains means that our culture lacks a kind of coherence or self-understanding, and that's a dangerous place to be facing big problems that require a collaboration of all of us, like climate change.
So how do you bridge those gaps, and do you think you'll see that happen in the near future?
One way I try to bridge those gaps is by having conversations, by going to artists and scientists in other domains and conversing with them. There's no replacement for that. But the second way I try to bridge those gaps is by something which is almost as good, which is writing a book for all the other people on the frontiers of knowledge to read, as well as all the other people who are concerned with our future.
You mentioned climate change a moment ago. How does the laws of physics, how does that involve, say, our response to climate change? Also, I know I understand the book goes into economic theory and sort of what's happened in terms of our economy and the recession and the sort.
Well, let me take them one at a time.
Sure.
It's not that there's a direct connection between the issues that I talk about when I'm talking about the role of time, say, in relativity theory or quantum theory, and the dynamics of the climate. But being a scientist, you know how to evaluate claims, and you know how to particularly evaluate uncertainty about the future. See, there's a line of the climate skeptics is that we can't be completely, we know that, I think everybody concedes by now that the climate is warming, and anybody rational concedes that that's due to the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere as a result of industry and cars and so forth. Nobody reasonable disputes that, so the climate skeptics say, but the models by which people try to predict the outcome of what the consequences will be 40 or 50 or 100 years from now have uncertainties built into them, and therefore we shouldn't do anything. And that's insane in my view. That's like saying, it's not likely that your house is going to burn down, therefore you don't buy fire insurance for your house. The fact is that the models are imperfect, but as a scientist, that doesn't scare us. We understand that predictions about the future are always uncertain, but the uncertainties range from the climate will warm, say, to 2 degrees Celsius, to the climate will warm to 8 or 10 degrees Celsius. That's the difference between humanity squeaking through a challenge that we can squeak through if we all work together and a total catastrophe. Now, that is very uncertain, but the conclusion that I draw from that is that a rational response to that is to begin to prepare now for the full range of possible outcomes. In other words, to start acting now to strongly reduce the carbon we put into the air and to prepare to deal with the consequences of the carbon that we already are putting in the air.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your view on economics and sort of the recession and the sort, what conclusions have you come to?
Well, the idea that truth is timeless and that the best understood systems are therefore understood in a way that makes them static has infected economic theory. Economic theory, unfortunately, has been modeled on physics and on a misunderstanding of physics. And so there's a governing economic theory called neoclassical economics, which has a notion of equilibrium, and they naively like to say that the market, as they, some conservative economists, like to argue that their models show that if left alone without regulation, without political interference, a market will go to a point of equilibrium, and at the point of equilibrium, everybody will be maximally happy and maximally well off. And therefore, that's an argument. This is an argument that was used to reduce regulation, especially in the United States, but also to some extent in Canada and Europe. Now, the problem is that even on the terms that the model asserts is the right way to measure the economy or a market, there turn out to be not one such equilibria, but a large number of them. And it turns out the real markets spend their time moving from equilibria to equilibria, developing in time. So which equilibria you're going to be in depends on history, depends on innovation, depends on accident. There's one equilibrium where Microsoft is dominant in its world. There's another equilibrium where Apple is dominant. There's another equilibrium where a company that fell apart in its first year actually became dominant, and so on. And so if history matters, if time matters, and therefore regulation matters and politics matters, we need an economic theory which takes time into effect and which takes the full dynamics of society and innovation and accident into effect.
What can there be a connection between faith, say religion, and science?
You know, I don't like to get into that, and the reason is that I believe in two principles that govern science and which also govern a democratic society. And the first principle is that when there's an argument which can be settled by referring to public evidence, by rational argument, we must be guided by rationality and regard that argument as settled, even if it means that we have to change our mind, even if it means that a theory that we may have proposed is wrong. That's the first principle, and that's why science progresses, and that's why juries and judges are able to make up their minds in a democratic society. But the second principle is that there are cases where there's a disagreement about something and the evidence does not suffice to decide it. Rational argument from the evidence still leaves people with divergent views. And the second principle, I believe, of a democratic society is that we must, in these cases, be tolerant of people with different views. So my attitude to people of faith and religion is, as long as they don't try to challenge science in the areas where the evidence does decide the matter, for example, evolution and climate change, I'm happy to live in a tolerant democratic society where they are free to have whatever religious faith and beliefs they want to.
Now, these books of yours, this is the fourth book, Time Reborn, they're quite popular with general readers. What's the response been from the scientific community? Are you some sort of pariah there?
Not at all. My first book, Life of the Cosmos, proposed that there needs to be what we call a landscape of theories, and that is that there isn't just one theory that's mathematically possible, but there's a whole spate of different possible theories of nature, and the way to understand which one nature chooses is to, as I said before, have a dynamics of theories, have the theories subject to change and evolution as the universe evolves. And that idea, it wasn't actually, it didn't turn out to be my original idea. It goes back to philosophers in the 19th century and has been speculated about since by various physicists and philosophers, but that idea was at first a little controversial within my community, but by about 2003 it was taken up by large numbers of people. There are controversies or disagreements within the profession. There are different approaches to open problems. Indeed, that's my second principle, that there should be differences of opinion, and there should be scientists pursuing different points of view and different hypotheses in an area where the evidence has not yet decided what's right yet. And so I am an originator of one point of view about the unification of physics. There are hundreds of people around the world who work on that. There are thousands of people who work on the whole range of other points of view and research programs, and there's a healthy debate amongst us, but this is part of the natural house of science.
I've enjoyed talking to you today. I'm working through the book and enjoying it, so continued good luck with it, Professor Smolin.
Thank you very much.
The website for more is leesmolin.com. The book is called Time Reborn, From the Crisis in Physics to the Future of the Universe. It's published by Knopf. It's author Lee Smolin on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.